Hello, welcome to On The Mic. My name is Mike Goldman, the podcast about people who are on the mic for a living. Thanks, Bendigo. Just got back, hosted the Business Excellence Awards. Excellent, Smithers. Or like Bond villain, excellent, Mr. Bond. Or like Kylie Mole. It's so excellent. Maybe I'm getting carried away on the excellent thing. But thank you to Excellent Bendigo for having me and Jason Tay, Leah Satori from B Bendigo, the Alumbra Theatre in the old Bendigo jail. It was awesome. Then I went to the Rocks on Roslyn. Nice little bar. Got a little bit tanked. And Mr. Biebs till like 3 a.m. with the staff outside, even though they were closed. I'm sure that was illegal, but we hung out there and drank. Yee-hoo! Thank you to the Schuller Studio for having me as well. That's a nice hotel. I'm sorry about the mess I made. Big congratulations to the winner from Frankie & Co., the owner, Paige Davies, the Bendigo Business Excellence Awards Business of the Year. If you'd like to see an interview with Paige, go to my Facebook page, facebook.com/Mike Goldman Live. And if you'd like to support this podcast, please go to patreon.com/onthemic, patreon.com/onthemic, M-I-K-E. Behind the scenes footage, you even get your name mentioned here in the podcast as well. Yes, we can be bought. Might even put you on the show. Little donation helps people like Rachel, who edit the show, get paid so that she can actually eat. Thank you, Rachel. You're amazing. So patreon.com/onthemic. Thanks to Apple Podcasts and Libsyn for hosting this On The Mic with world-renowned comedian Ben Darso. He's been a stand-up comedian for 15 years. Amazing talent, this guy. Played a show with him a couple of weeks ago at Luna Park at the Sydney Comedy Club, which is owned by Darren Sanders. We have a bit of a chat about him, what his plans are for the future. If you're a fan of comedy, or maybe even you want to be a comedian, then this is a good one to listen to, how he got started, etc. He's 35. He holds a finance degree. He's from Radelaide. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks to Apple Podcasts and Libsyn for hosting this On The Mic. Here is world-renowned comedian Ben Darso.
Check. 1, 2, 3.
On the mic.
Test, test, test.
With Mike Goldman.
Hello.
Hey, mate, how are you?
Good, good, good.
Welcome to Sydney Town. How's it treating you?
Loving it here. Yeah, having a great run of gigs.
Yeah, you are. You've been traveling all over the world. You've been doing stand-up comedy for, what, 10 years or something now?
Yeah, you get lots in the distance, but it'll be, I think it's getting close to 15 now.
15? Let me edit that. We can start again. It's only at the start. And now here's Ben Darso, who's been doing stand-up comedy for 15 years. Ben, great to see you. How are you enjoying it?
Oh. Really good. Thank you for acknowledging those first 5 years. I appreciate it.
You played Luna Park the other night.
Yeah.
I heard the MC was pretty shit, but it was a good night otherwise.
Don't be too hard on yourself there, Mike. The Sydney Comedy Club there, a lot of fun. Had Happy Endings Comedy Club in the King's Cross last night and a couple of weeks coming up at the Comedy Store in Fox Studios.
Happy Endings Comedy Club. So did you have to do a bit of extra work when you got off the stage or what?
I think there are a few people in there under the impression it's a different kind of club.
Speaking of strange names, strange clubs, you've done some gigs in Malaysia recently. What was that like?
Malaysia's amazing, and it's actually the Crack House Comedy Club is the main stand-up comedy club there. So try explaining that to customs in a country that has the death penalty for drugs.
So you've gone from the Crack House to the Happy Endings. What's next? The Punch in Your Face Comedy Club.
Just playing all the big clubs. That's what I'm doing.
All the big festivals that you've been playing. You've done the Melbourne Comedy Festival, the Perth Festival, and Fringe Festivals. So what's been the best one so far?
I think I've got a little following sort of growing over there in Perth. So Perth's a really nice month. It's the first place I've ever been where you walk to your venue and there's people snaking around, you know, the corner, like lining up for your show, which is a super cool feeling.
Yeah, you sold like 1,500 tickets. What was that like? Was that your biggest sellout ever?
Yeah, it was really cool. CommBank were happy with me. I'm back in the game.
So you're paying off your bills and your debts?
Yeah, just clearing the slate.
So June 5 at the Old Manly Boat Shed, the Harold Park Hotel on the 6th, the 7th, the Oatley Hotel, and the 8th to the 10th at the Comedy Store. If you want to see the dates, facebook.com/Ben Darso. Where's the other places you played all over the world? I mean, we know you did Malaysia and you've done all the comedy festivals in Australia. Have you done over in Canada and some of those other big festivals?
Yeah, I was over in Vancouver each of the last couple of years on the west coast of Canada. And it's funny you mention it. I actually had an email in my inbox on Friday from the manager of the club saying, hey, you're planning on coming back this summer. Just an amazing scene over there. And I think you have that point of difference as an Australian as well. So, yeah, Vancouver is one of the most amazing places I've ever been.
Is Vancouver the biggest comedy town in the world, would you say?
Over in Canada, I think they say Toronto is a really strong scene throughout the year. Montreal, the comedy festival, is invite only, just for laughs, and that's a really exclusive festival. I'd love to do that in the next couple of years, hopefully. Vancouver's one of those scenes. It was very, very similar to Sydney. A lot of really good rooms, a high standard of comedy, and I felt very welcome there really quickly.
So that'd be the biggest in the world, like even bigger than like a New York or an LA comedy scene, do you think?
I think New York and LA are probably always going to be right up there at the top. New York, a lot of comics really working on being comics. LA, it looks like there's a lot of people getting up on stage to do comedy who more so want an acting job, and they're sort of up there hoping to perhaps impress an agent. I think that's how those two scenes will always be.
So, mate, how'd you get into this comedy game?
Man, I just fell into it. I was doing a finance degree back when I was 20 years old. I did Raw Comedy, run by Triple J and the Melbourne Comedy Festival. Enjoyed doing it. And by the time I'd finished my degree, I just felt like continuing with stand-up.
So, where'd you come in the comedy competition?
I think the first year I did it, I made the state final. The third attempt I had at it, I won it in SA and got to do the national final with some really talented comics who've gone on to have a professional career.
Wow, cool.
Matt O'Kine, Claire Hooper, Nick Sun, Sam Bowring. So it was a really good year to be involved in.
Matt O'Kine's the Triple J breakfast announcer, and I saw a poster for a gig that you guys did, and they flipped it around.
Yeah, they did. They had my bio with Matt's face, and they had Matt's bio with my face. So it was a cultural exchange.
Is that someone just messing with you, or do you think that was actually meant to be like that?
To be honest, I think that was someone who made an honest mistake. And it was kind of, I mean, Matt got a bit, you know, mainstream, a bit of a mainstream profile going with his Triple J. It was before that, so I think it was an honest mistake.
Did he get offended?
I think either or both of us just got a laugh.
So who talked you into doing this whole comedy thing? Was it your mate said that you were funny, or you just thought that's something that I really want to do? Did you already have a few gags up your sleeve? Did you get up at a Christmas party and make a speech and everyone laughed at it?
Honestly, I think the first stand-up comedy I did was my mate's 18th birthday party. We'd known each other since we were 3 or 4 years old, so I had an entire lifetime of material on him. Got up and did the speech, and it just felt like stand-up, and I was like, this is an amazing buzz. I'm going to keep doing this.
And so you were still friends after it?
We were, actually, and he drank so much that night that he had a few days in the hospital afterwards, but when he recovered, I don't think he remembered a word of it.
Do you remember any of the gags, your first gags that you did about your mate on stage that day?
You know, to be honest, and this sounds horrific now as a professional comic, but I reckon I kind of ripped off some stand-up of some comics at the time and kind of adjusted it to my mate's situation and kind of used that as the structure for what I was doing.
Does that happen a lot in your industry? Do people plagiarize ideas?
I think people cross over a lot on what they talk about, but I mean, it's just so frowned upon. It's not like sort of music where you can be a cover band and kind of pay tribute to another another act. Like it self-regulates pretty well, I think, this industry.
What do you mean by self-regulates? Like if you do something on stage, like the boss of the comedy club is like, you can't do that, that's someone else's jokes.
It might be a little bit like that, or it might be another comic sort of mentioning, hey, do you know so-and-so does that? Or just, you know, just a general kind of attitude towards you if it starts happening a fair bit.
Do you remember a few years ago there was a guy on X Factor that did an entire routine that was someone else's?
Yeah, I do remember. I mean, I feel for that dude that he kind of decided to do that, because that was outrageous on national or international TV, doing something where that was always going to be picked up within a few minutes. Yeah, I think the whole comedy industry just looked at that and went, what are you doing?
So who's your favourite comedian? Who was someone that you looked up to and you thought, I want to be like that guy?
Jerry Seinfeld was the first person I ever saw. I listened to a CD of his when I was about 18 years old. Eddie Murphy was the next guy I saw. I saw his Delirious album, I think.
Eddie.
Yeah.
Goonigugu. What the fuck does Goonigugu mean?
I mean, it was a classic at the time. It's funny, Eddie actually now says, he goes, I look back at who I was, you know, when I was 20 years old and doing that, and he's like, I wouldn't say any of the same things, but I think back in the time that was an iconic comedy album. Now Dave Chappelle, Louis C.K., I think Ricky Gervais is pretty close to as funny as we've got on this planet at the moment.
Eddie Murphy's unreal. I remember growing up as a kid seeing him in his leather outfit up there on stage. I got an ice cream. You could drop that shit in dog shit and just scrape it off and still eat it. It's just sprinkles. G.I. Joe swimming through the water. And then the big brown shark came. I love that stuff. Is that like your goal, to do a comedy recording that would be that iconic, that's remembered for years to come?
Yeah. I guess it would be. I mean, Eddie was just an amazing guy. If you look sort of at the writing of what he was doing, I mean, and anyone else, like if you or I tried to do that, I don't think we could pull it off. But like, it was the guy's personality, you know, that allowed him to do that. I think that's what you want to do. You want to establish your own sort of brand of comedy that people are really uniquely finding from you.
If you've ever heard him in interviews or read interviews with him, he said when he first got to LA, he used to put on this character voice and pretend to be his own agent and like book his gigs and his own PR agent. It's something I think that's really important in the comedy industry, where you got to get out there and promote yourself so that people go to your gigs. A lot of people leave it to the venues and stuff like that. So I think, you know, doing podcasts and getting out there and pushing your name around town. Do you have like an agent or someone like that does that for you?
Technically, I'm not managed at the moment. I have a lot of people I look to for advice though, definitely. And I think, you know, if you can take a little bit here and there from the people around you whose opinions you value, that's the way I'm just moving forward step by step at the moment.
Yeah. Steve Martin said in the masterclass that I downloaded just recently, because I wanted to see what he was on about. I mean, he's a very experienced stand-up comedy guy. He said, LA is the best place to be in the world because you just need to be in pointing vicinity so people can go, oh yeah, that guy's pretty good. You got to be around to be seen, so potentially you can get those kind of gigs. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think there's so much truth to that. And the one thing I really realized when I went to LA is no one there cares what you've done outside of LA.
They don't give a shit, do they? I lived there for 2 years. Hi, I hosted Big Brother Friday Night Live. I have my own talk. We don't give a shit. There's 20 million people in Australia, 26 million or whatever. There's 350 million in America. Big deal.
It's so true. I mean, you know, what you've done is the pinnacle of the industry here in a country that's not small, and you go there and it really is about what you can build up in LA before you're given any kind of cred or seriousness over there.
Yeah, so have you done gigs over there as well?
I did, yeah. I've done gigs there the last couple of years. Managed to get onto some pretty sweet little lineups. LA is a completely different industry. Here in Australia, you can make a genuinely good living just doing stand-up comedy. In LA, even the really good comics are working for like $20 a night. Yeah. It's just to build up their profile.
I met the Jewish guy who owns the Laugh Factory. And he said, you want to come down here and MC? You can come down and do it for free. I'll book you. And we got an opening in 6 months' time. So that's how many people want to do it and want to MC and just be on stage in LA. Eventually they'll probably end up paying so they can get on stage and do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I would say there's so much truth to that. You can make a big kind of moral stance about the fact that your art form requires more money than you're being offered, but if you don't want that gig, champ, there's about 1,000, literally thousands of people that will take that.
Yeah, it's tough over there. But, you know, when I was there, I'd see people doing stand-up and then I'd go, wow, these guys are incredible, and they wouldn't be doing anything on TV or in movies. And then like 2 or 3 years later, you go, oh yeah, I remember seeing that guy at the Laugh Factory or the Comedy Store. So is that you on stage? Is that Ben Darso, or is this a character that you made up?
It's definitely me. It's an aspect of me. I think they sort of say with a lot of comics, it's a particular aspect of your character under the microscope. So it's something genuine, but it might just be like a dominant trait within your personality that kind of comes out and defines who you are on stage.
So how do you choose what parts of your personality that you're going to bring out on stage? Is it just general conversations with people and hearing when they laugh at something you might say and go, right, I'm going to write that down. That's going to be part of my act. Or is it just something that eventually came out after doing lots of shows?
Yeah, I don't think it is something that you choose. I mean, perhaps for some people, maybe early on, they're trying to find who they are. They might consciously think about it. I think it's one of those things that you just allow to develop. And over time, your style intrinsically changes. A mate of mine ran into Billy Connolly, a comedian mate of mine, and he asked Billy for a bit of advice. And Billy said, just let your style find you.
Right. So what do you think he meant by that? Just get up there and keep telling the jokes until your personality comes out on stage? Or does he mean when you're actually writing it down? I mean, you guys write all this stuff out until it's entrenched and ingrained in your head.
Yeah, I imagine he was probably talking in both senses. Probably more so just who you are in terms of how you're presenting on stage, I would say.
Yeah. What do you think of Billy? He's amazing, isn't he?
Billy's an enigma. I think he's going to be, you know, one of those guys that everyone looks back on or appreciates as an all-time great. I don't think there's any question about that.
So you've been doing a few cruises. What's it like doing the comedy cruises? You just get up and do the same act every night, or you go, shit, they've already heard my routine from last night. I got to make up a whole new one tonight.
I do a lot of impro, so like it's sort of rarely kind of a copy-paste script. To be perfectly honest with you, I love the cruises. There's a lot of comics out there who don't enjoy it, and I respect that. But from my perspective, it's a 300-seat theatre. Mm. It's a bunch of people up late at 10:30 at night who've chosen to be there. They're on holidays in a good mood.
Yeah.
And I'm having some of the most fun gigs of my life in there.
Yeah, it's a wedding crowd, isn't it? They all drunk?
Not as horrifically as you might think. Before I started doing them, I thought, is this just going to be, you know, heckles coming at you from 360 degrees? But they're well lubricated. But I think in that theatre environment, there's something that that people intrinsically respect about looking down there at a big stage.
How do you handle the hecklers? Especially if you're going to be having breakfast with them the next morning.
Yeah, true. I think in terms of environments where if you had a bad gig, like how bad it would be, I think that's right up there, because you're literally just walking past the very people that you might not have impressed the previous night.
Oh, no. So speaking of, that was a good gig, but bad gigs, I think, I don't know if it was that bad, but the smallest gig you did was for three people at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. What's the story with that one? Bad promotion on their part, obviously.
That's true. That was it was only about 6 or 7 weeks ago. Three people, three ladies between the age of 50 and 90 from the same family. And the fella I had flyering for me literally found them about 5 minutes before my show started. And it was on a night when I had a Herald Sun reviewer also in attendance. And so it was a reviewer, three ladies and myself. And go in there and commit hard.
What did you do? Did you just act as if, you know, it's 1,500 people? Or did you speak to them all individually? Yeah, how did you work it?
I think it was unavoidable to acknowledge the situation. So well and truly just played with what I had. And they were magical. I had a reviewer who came in and didn't write me off just because of the situation. And honestly, the five of us were laughing hard before I'd even said a word, just at the absurdity of the situation.
Well, good on you for getting up there, because I know a lot of comedians who'd go, fuck this, and they wouldn't even get up on stage. And you got a 5-star review.
Yeah. I got 4 stars, but I appreciate that. It was a really positive review, and I think it was just one of those moments where it's like, let's make something of this. You could easily call that gig off. There'd be no review of your show. The festival's so competitive, you wouldn't get that reviewer back to your show and have that opportunity of some publicity. And it really caught on. I think I got a lot of value out of committing to it. The paper did an article on the review. Triple M read the article on the review. Billy Brownless and James Brayshaw had me in there, and were just great guys, and it really kind of boosted up my numbers for the next couple of weeks.
You did get a 5-star review. That was from Joy Lean, one of the country ladies that came to the show. I spoke to them. I didn't actually read the article. So the best gig, I guess, is something like you would have played in, in Perth. Would it have been one of the best gigs you played, or what's the most memorable one for you?
It's really hard to define. I think gigs are memorable for different reasons. I think Perth's the first place I've really cracked through where I've seen those numbers, and there's something very special about walking into a room where 150 people have specifically come to see you. You know, I've done lots of club gigs where there's 200, 300, 400 people, but they're there for a night of comedy. I think there's something really special where you're like, these people out of a competitive festival came and chose me.
Yeah, you are, man. You're killing it. You're a brilliant comedian. Your gags are like a shotgun. You just fire them out nonstop. Do you think does it feel better for you on stage when you have a bigger crowd rather than like a, you know, 200 or 300 people? Because like when I was, you know, on stage doing stuff like Big Brother, we'd have 2,000 people. I'd have to come out there and do crowd warm-up. And it'd be a bit daunting at first, but once you get into it, laughter's infectious and it just carries through the whole room. Once you get over that initial sort of speed hump, does it make it a lot easier for you to speak to a crowd that big, do you think?
I would definitely agree with that. And, you know, people often ask that, you know, is it scary in front of a big crowd? I think it's infinitely scarier when you have those situations where there's 3 or 4 people, and because that same degree of energy isn't there. So much of comedy, it's not just what you're saying, but it's that dynamic that, as you said, with you hosting the Big Brother event in front of 2,000 people, it just starts bouncing around. And that's so much easier to create that when you've got, you know, a couple of hundred people in that room.
Have you ever had anything happen when you're on stage that you just go, oh no, this is the worst moment of my life? Like something you've said or something you've done hasn't gone according to plan, like you've made a mistake, anything like that that first comes to mind?
That's really interesting that you asked that. Last night at Happy Endings Comedy Club, I asked, I asked a lady. She was just there with a couple of her children. They were all visiting from Tasmania, and I just, I couldn't quite see past the light. And I just said, you know, is your husband here as well? Is it the full family? And she said, oh, my husband and I were married for 50 years, and he actually passed away at the end of last year. And the air just sucked out of the room like a vacuum. And
oh, don't you hate that?
Yeah, you know, it's just an innocent question. Yeah. The response is a really unfortunate response. And I think just collectively, everyone in there just kind of took a moment. And then I just acknowledged it instinctively and just said, you know, we all feel for you and thanks so much for being out here tonight. Mm. Room kind of burst into a little applause for her. And we moved on. It was just one of those bizarre moments where you just, I think, have to go with your gut reaction to how to play it.
Yeah, that's full on. And lucky before that, you didn't say, oh, is your husband, sorry, brother here? Or where are you from? Inceston? I mean, sorry, Launceston? And then, oh, no, my husband died. So that could have been a lot more worse for you. I remember I was on stage once and it was one of those Big Brother events, actually. And I usually get everyone out of their chairs at the start of the show. I go, come on, let's go crazy. We're going to kick someone out of the house tonight. You know, who wants to win some prizes? I'm giving away plasma screen TVs and T-shirts and all sorts of other crazy stuff. And one guy wasn't getting up and he was just sitting there with his arms folded. And I'm like, what's wrong with you, buddy? Come on, get off your ass and clap. And he still wasn't. And I just picked on him, went to town on this guy for like the next 20 minutes. And the executive producer of the show came over to me and he's quite a pompous man. His name's Howard Parker, very well spoken. He says, Goldman, do you realize who you're insulting in the front row of the theater? And I go, no, but he's a dickhead because he won't even stand up and clap. And he goes, here's the chairman and director of Southern Star Endemol. He pays your bills. And I go, okay, that's bad. Like I should have just left him alone. But really, I mean, he should get up and clap with everyone else. And he said he can't get up and clap. He's in a wheelchair.
Oh man, yeah, I saw that coming as soon as you started talking. Yeah, that's just one of those moments where you're like, oh man, I've done it.
But they moved him out of the wheelchair and he just into a normal chair. And I'm like, oh, and I went up and said sorry. And we actually became really good friends after that. And I hung out with him a few times, but. Just when you do those horrible things on stage, actually, you know, I've made a career out of it. The amount of times I've fucked up, not just on stage, on national television. Like I was hosting the fireworks for Channel 10 underneath the Harbour Bridge at Dawes Point, and it was a bad enough broadcast anyway. It got slagged off all over the newspapers the next day because Matthew Newton was hosting part of it and he was drunk with John Foreman on the television a couple of days earlier. And I got Brian Fitzgerald to dress as Paris Hilton and in a pink dress and a blonde wig and, you know, pretend that he was making out with someone. And then I didn't know that they were going to cross to me to throw to the package for all the shows coming up on Channel 10 in 2007. Mm-hmm. And I'm just standing there with my earpiece in and they say, oh, Mike, we're having problems with the Opera House. We're going to have to cross to you in 5, 4. And I'm like, what am I doing? Oh, just throw to the packages for 2007. I went, yeah, okay, cool. Hey, we're having fun over here at Dawes Point. It's a rocking show underneath the Harbour Bridge. The fireworks are coming up. But before the fireworks happen, 2006 has been a great year on 10. And 2007 is even going to be even better on 7. Take a look at what's coming up. I mean, on 10.
Oh, man.
I said the wrong network.
Oh, dude, and you were so fluent to that point. Like, I'm impressed with how easily everything else came out.
Oh, I completely stuffed it. And I got messages from, like, the network boss, from the program manager, from the producers, like, even Bree and Fitzy, who I was there with. They're like, what are you doing? Why'd you say that? The best message I got was from my mum. Mum wrote a message to me saying, Mike, Happy New Year. Great show. Love Kerry Stokes.
Glad that your mum could see the funny side of it.
Oh, that was shocking. But, you know, we come back from those. We bounce back. Some say I probably shouldn't have. Thank God I've still barely keeping my career alive with MC gigs at the Luna Park Comedy Club run by Darren Sanders. How good is Darren Sanders?
Darren's a lovable, big, grumpy bear.
He is, isn't he? With the emphasis on grumpy. He's done like three series of his own stand-up comedy show. Or it's more like a Tonight Show. It's bullshit that Australia doesn't have a Tonight Show. We need a Tonight Show here. It's embarrassing when we have all these big celebrities come out and all we can offer them is a crappy breakfast television show or another chat show that's put on in between infomercials. We need like a Rove or someone like you should do a Tonight Show. And that's why he's got up and done his own with his own money. I think he's doing another one late this year. And he said he's going to do it just from his house.
That's pretty cool. I have seen a couple of episodes of what Darren filmed. I think it's really good. Darren has a naturally, like, really personable style. He's well-connected in the industry. It's funny stuff. There's another guy, John Conway, who has a Tonight Show sort of starting to spring up on television. He's been doing that live for a couple of years.
Where's that?
I believe that they filmed it, if I'm not mistaken, in the Cafe Lounge in Surry Hills, which is a beautiful little intimate comedy venue. I'm actually doing that tomorrow night, on Monday night.
Oh, cool. What channel's that on?
I think John's show is on ABC, if I'm not mistaken, but he's been one of those comics that's been steadily building a huge skill set in a very unique way, and hopefully for him, he really breaks through into that area of the market that you're talking about.
Well, that's how you do it. I mean, Rove started on one of the community channels in Melbourne. He did that for a few years, and then all of a sudden, Nine gave him a run for about a minute, and like Channel 9, if it doesn't rate the first week, they just pull it off the air. And then Channel 10 gave him a good long run, and it went really, really well. So hopefully your show keeps going. We can have some decent talent doing a Tonight Show like that. So your humour, would you describe it as like a self-deprecating observational humour?
Yeah, I would. I'd describe it first and foremost as observational stand-up. That's all my writing. It's an observational style of comedy, and then improvised each night with the crowd that's in there.
Because I saw something you did from way back in 2011 where you're talking about your hair, you know, and you know, getting asked for ID when you get into nightclubs, and you just show them your hair and say, I either need to be in hospital with hair like this, or you need your eyes checked. You said something along those lines. So how's your hair going? You're wearing hats on stage now. Is that a new decision?
Yeah, the horse is well and truly bolted. Okay. So this is like an iPhone 2.0. This is the upgraded look.
Yeah, cause, I mean, mine's getting that way. Like, look at the back there. You know, it's sort of starting to grow a bit, like solar seat. What is it? What do they call it? A solar panel for a sex machine? Or I'm growing too tall for my haircut? I had some hair cut out of the back and put it in the front. I'm serious. You want to see the scar?
Sure.
Yep, look, see the back there? Have a look at that there.
There it is. Yep.
And
yep.
See, like, in the front there?
Yep. I'm hearing you. I think hair's one of those interesting things for men. Like when I was sort of in my like mid-20s and you're starting to notice, you know, the hairline go back, it's one of the freakiest things. And then I think the ironic thing is here I are, you know, at 35, like that the hair's gone. Like I just shave it to, you know, a number one level now and I couldn't care less. It's weird. I look back at photos of myself, you know, in my mid-20s when I knew that I cared about it, and I'm looking at it and I'm like, I had a truckload of hair still there. It all goes and you actually don't give a shit.
Do you you just shave it, or what, do you wax it, or you have electric? Look at that there. You've got a good shaped round head.
I think I'm lucky that my head's not a horrific shape, and I can get away with it.
No, I shaved my head a few years ago, and mine's actually shaped like a peanut under there. and I have this massive bump at the back of my head, and when I'd shave my head, people would look at the back of my head and they go, "What's that? What's going on with the back of your head? What are you done there? What's going on?" Have a feel of this bump.
Oh, there's a good little bump there. Definitely. Yep, I'm feeling it.
Do you think I was dropped on my head as a child or something like that?
It could possibly have been. I actually had a really heavy glass door get shut on my forehead when I was about 3 or 4 years old, back in Brunei, where I was born, and got whisked off to the hospital, and I've got a scar that I think will be with me for forever.
I got one here, like look, right on my right eyebrow, where I was being chased by my brother when I was about 7, and I pushed a door the wrong way in a house that I'd lived and I was pretty much born in, so I should have known which way the door went. Door bounced back, and the lock on the door smashed me right there in the eye. But well, how do we get talking about scars? Oh, that's right, hair and all that kind of stuff. We sort of started on self-deprecating humour, but it's just become not funny at all. We're just talking about each other's battle scars. It's quite embarrassing.
This is how easily guys can transition into battle scar stories. One more though, while we're hot. My mum actually ran through a glass door when she was a kid. She has a scar that goes from her wrist all the way up to her bicep, and apparently came very close to losing her arm. As a kid.
Oh, that's horrible. Speaking of losing arms, I used to do this competition called Scar Search on the radio. People would ring up and say what kind of scars they had and all that kind of thing. Oh, you know, I've got a scar here, scar there, and they'd send in photos. And then I started doing it on television because it went so well, and people ringing up and explaining stories. You get people out of the crowd and they'd stand up on stage and they'd go, oh, look, this is where I cut my finger open. I'm actually showing Ben a scar right now. I cut my finger open when I was about 12 trying to open one of those SPC cans.
Oh, wow.
And I ripped my finger right open, and Mrs. Moss, my teacher, said, do you mind? Stand back. I'm trying to have a conversation here. And I go, no, but I cut my finger, and I pointed at her and squirted blood all over her shirt and went, and anyway, that's my scar, sorry. But so all these people are standing there on stage, and there's one lady there that's, I'm going through them all. Oh, this is a scar I got from an operation. This is my open heart surgery. Oh, this is an operation on my back. And there's one girl standing there with one arm. And I'm, well, that's not a scar. Is that, do I disqualify her? Or does
she automatically win? Like, yeah. Which way does that go?
But it went one step further. Like, we've interviewed everyone, and luckily she was the last one, because you want to interview all the good ones and have the best one to last. And she said her arm was bitten off by a shark. And everyone's like, wow, I gave her a round of applause. And she goes, no, just kidding, it was cancer. And I went, and then as she said that, her right leg fell off. She had like a plastic leg as well. And I'm like, and everyone's like, oh, everyone's shocked. And she goes, no, I did that on purpose. And so she won.
Man, what a great sense of humour.
Yeah, and so that was the last time I did that competition.
There's actually a young comic in Perth, Alicia Marsh, who I don't think she'd mind me talking about this, but she's quite open about it. But she has a finger in the place of her thumb on both of her hands, and she said that came from a shark attacking her on a boogie board as a kid.
She has a what? A finger on both of... What is it?
If you can picture where your thumbs are, yeah. She has a finger placed there to replicate how a thumb would be on her hand, yeah. Because both of her thumbs were bitten off when she was holding the top of her boogie board as a kid by a shark.
No. That's crazy. So she's thumbless.
Yeah, yeah. She's quite open about it. That's the story she gave me, and to the best of my understanding, she was being sincere about that.
Wow, that's freaky.
It's one of the freakiest things I've ever heard.
Adam Hills is someone who is legless, and he takes the piss out of it a lot, takes the piss out of himself. I was hosting the Hollywood Ashes in the States. It's like a celebrity cricket match, and I contacted him on Facebook and asked him to come out and play. And he's actually a really good cricketer, and he hit a six and his leg fell off and he hopped all the way from one end of the pitch to the other.
Man, you got to get it done somehow.
He's a legend. He's doing really well. Yeah. So where's it going for Ben Darso? What are you doing now? You're heading off into bigger theatres, or is it more acting for you? What's the story?
It's funny. I think a lot of comics use stand-up as a springboard into television or radio or acting or presenting. For me, at the moment, it's just about stand-up. I love the art form of stand-up. I want to get as good as I can get. I want to be world-class at this. And I just want to sort of transition from the clubs to the festivals, which I sort of already have. And I'd love to start sort of touring in the theatres in the next couple of years.
Yeah, cool. So will you ever explore like the acting side of things, or you want to get your own TV show, your Tonight Show? What's the plan?
It's funny, like at the moment I feel horrific at acting. If I get given a script and some instructions on where to turn, honestly, like I'm terrible. I'm like a primary school kid
What about skits like Kinney does, you know, or, you know, like a fast forward, full frontal kind of comedy skits and stuff like that? Are you ever going to do those kind of things, or maybe get your stand-up routines and act them out into a video?
You know that the latter, I think I could do. I reckon because my stuff is observational, a lot of it's situational as well. I think that could come through in a little. I guess you could call it a sketch show kind of thing. In terms of like any broader acting roles, I think I'd be one of those guys that could only ever play myself, and then you just copy paste them into a bunch of different scenarios.
I'd love to see you do that stuff, actually, because from watching your stand up and working with you as well, I think you're bang on. A lot of your stuff that you do would be perfect to just to film it in a real situation. Like you've got some of your comedy about the homeless guy and, you know, you have a conversation with him. Like you could so film that. Let's film it.
Let's do it.
I reckon we should film that in a couple of weeks and put it up on your YouTube page and see how it goes.
Yeah, I'm all for it. I was only actually thinking a couple of days ago, like I get when people are homeless, it's a tough situation for them. And I have a lot of empathy for that. And, you know, if I've ever got change in my pocket, I will give it. You know, I think it's really important to sort of help people like that. But at the same time, like the joke that perhaps you're referring to on stage, I find really interesting presenting this different perspective on it where I've got a mortgage, I've got a business loan, I've got a university debt, I've got a credit card that's maxed out. And I'm sort of looked to, you know, for a little bit of change sometimes or, you know, the answer to someone else's problems. And I think it's a funny, like, alternative perspective on it where it's like, man, I am stacked with my own issues that I'm dealing with and getting up every day to kind of face. And I was only sort of thinking about maybe taking like a photo of me with sort of, you know, that list of debts written on a piece of cardboard or something like that, sort of sitting there in the city. I don't know if that'd be like offensive or if that would actually make quite an interesting and perhaps funny point.
And you're trying to get to where he is.
I'm trying to get to where he is, a clean slate, debt-free, neutral position.
Maybe you want to borrow something off him.
I don't know, the sleeping bag. I mean, we could use this.
One of your biggest gags. So if you're thinking of seeing Ben, you don't need to go now because you've heard it here on the show. No, but let's film that. I reckon we film that. Can I be the homeless guy? I'll grow my beard a bit more. Or maybe should I have a fake beard?
I think rock whatever you feel like. Yeah, let the beard grow. Let's make this authentic.
Or do you think people will go, hang on a minute, that guy's homeless. Isn't that guy that used to be on Big Brother? Oh, no, that makes sense. Yeah, he would be homeless.
Yeah, I think ever since that Channel 10, Channel 7 mishap, you know, this is where it's ended up, guys.
It's all over. That's where we're out. Ben Darcy, thanks so much for being on the mic. And those gigs, again, if you want to go and see them, facebook.com/Ben Darcy. And the 5th of June, the Old Manly Boat Shed, 6th Harold Park Hotel, 7th the Oatley Hotel, 8th to the 10th at the Comedy Store, facebook.com/Ben Darcy. You legend, thanks for being on the mic.
It's been awesome, Mike. Appreciate you having me, man.
You've been listening to On The Mic with Mike Goldman. Subscribe, download and review at iTunes, Audioboom, Stitcher or your favourite podcasting app. For more, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. This has been another quality podcast production from Bytes.com.